his way of telling her how she'll end up if her husband doesn't meet his demands.
What demands? She asked, alarmed. You didn't say anything about any demands.
Relax. There are none yet. But like you said, a ransom note could arrive any day.
That's true.
He finished his wine, a long sip. So, for a guy whose stomach is tight and nuts, I've come up with some pretty good theories, don't you think?
Pretty good.
You got any better ones?
Andy didn't have to answer, but she suddenly felt as though he had a right to know. Suffering was its own rite of passage.
None better, she replied. Just different.
How so?
You're not going to like it.
Try me.
It's a remote possibility, but we can't rule it out.
I'm listening.
It's something we feel that we have to consider in light of your wife's history.
History?
The bulimia, the shoplifting, the postpartum depression, the false accusations of spousal abuse against you, her general psychological instability.
I don't see how any of that explains how her fingerprints ended up on a payphone in Oregon.
She hesitated. It was Lundquist's theory, one she didn't fully embrace. It pained her to repeat it.
It raises the possibility that she was there willingly.
What the hell are you saying? She's an accomplice?
Remote possibility, but yes.
That's preposterous.
It might explain why she's alive, assuming she's alive.
My wife is no killer.
It could explain why there's no ransom demand.
Are you seriously considering this?
It is a theory.
It's a terrible theory,
he said sharply. I sincerely hope you're right.
I know I'm right.
His face was flushed, both from the wine and adrenaline. He said nothing for a minute or two, staring blankly at his empty glass. Finally, he spoke again, though he sounded a hint less sure of himself.
That just can't be.
Chapter 33. On Wednesday, Andy decided to start at the very beginning. Victim number one. Fears that Gus's wife was a victim had shifted their focus toward the Beth Wheatley lookalikes, victims 3, 4, and 5. But if she was an accomplice, maybe the answer lay with the men, the first two victims. Early that morning, she arrived at 151 Chatham Lane, home of the late Patrick Sullivan. He had been the first of two brown-eyed, 51-year-old Ford pickup truck-driving, divorced men to have been handcuffed in his living room, strangled on the couch, and stabbed exactly 11 times. A far cry from the three women found hanging in trees. If it wasn't for the same triple-braided, 3/4-inch yellow nylon rope, police would never have made the connection. Andy spent more than an hour at Sullivan's house, taking notes, some on paper and some mental. Detective Kessler acted as tour guide. He had been over the house thoroughly and repeatedly as part of his homicide investigation. Around 9 o'clock, they finished and headed to the vacant home of Victor Milner, victim number two. The house was near the Sammamish River in north-central King County, an area popular with hot air balloonists who could be seen peacefully drifting overhead on most any summer day or clear autumn evening. Winters were another story. The day had started gray and stayed that way, showing occasional signs of movement from dull to threatening. No breeze to speak of. A light mist was floating more than falling, not near enough to warrant an umbrella. The slow and steady saturation had turned everything darker, the asphalt blacker, the canvas awning greener, her mood gloomier. Andy stood at the end of the sidewalk for the broad view. It was a relatively new single-family home, one more box in a building craze that had tripled the Redmond area population in the last 2 decades. Structurally, it looked like many of the new frame houses in the same development. The most striking thing, however, was how strongly it resembled the first victim's house, miles away in a different part of town, a totally different neighborhood. The similarities weren't in the architecture or general design, they were in the details. The green awning that extended from the garage, the wooden flower boxes on the windowsills, the hanging plants and latticework around the front porch. Andy had read the police reports and had noted the curious similarities, but words could leave the reader with the impression that it was mere coincidence. She had seen the photographs, too, but they hadn't captured the feeling. A personal visit left no room for doubt. The killer had very specific criteria. He profiled his victims.
"You're just going to stand in the rain?" said Kessler.
She started, her concentration broken. "I'm sorry, what?"
"You want to go in?"
"Yeah, of course." She followed him up the sidewalk and climbed the three stairs on the front porch, the same number as the last house. Kessler pulled aside the crime tape and reached for his key. At that moment, Andy focused on one of the major differences between the two crime scenes. "No forced entry," she said, thinking aloud.
"It's noted in the first officer's report," he said. "That shouldn't be news to you."
"It's not. My perspective is just changing a little."
"How so?"
One of the things Victoria Santos tried to reconcile was the fact that at Sullivan's house, the lock had been picked and the door broken open. Here, there was no sign of forcible entry, yet the crime scene looks exactly the same.
"It's probably like Santos said. He forced his way inside the first time, talked his way in the second. Both guys ended up handcuffed. It's the same ritual once you get the victim under control."
"That explanation makes sense if you're trying to understand why a work-alone killer would change his entry, M.O.
"You got something else in mind?"
"Just testing my supervisor's accomplice theory." Kessler shook his head, smirking.
"Look, I'm the last guy to cross a potential suspect off the list willy-nilly. But Beth Wheatley is no serial killer sidekick."
"That's the same reaction I had, at first. But we have to look at the evidence. One scenario suggests that whatever con or ruse the killer used to gain access the second time didn't work with the first victim. He had to force his way in."
"Maybe the first victim was more careful than the second, more savvy."
"Possibly," said Andy.
"Or maybe practice makes perfect. He had a little more polish on his ruse the second time. He was more persuasive with victim number two.
Or maybe he had help the second time." He nodded slowly, seeming to pick up her drift.
"Like an attractive 35-year-old woman. Someone who could knock on the front door, say her car broke down, and ask to use the phone. A 51-year-old man would be more willing to open the door for an attractive woman in distress.
For that matter, so would another woman."
Again, he read her mind. "As in the next three victims, all female."
They exchanged a long look, as if each were waiting for the other to say it was ridiculous. Neither one did. Kessler raised an eyebrow, intrigued.
"So, where does that leave us?"
Andy watched as he turned the key and opened the door. It was like unsealing a tomb, dark and silent. The residual odor of death wafted from the living room. "Confused," she said, as she stepped inside.
Gus didn't leave the house all day. The prospect of a phone call kept him there. Beth, her kidnapper, someone responding to his ad. The ad had run again in this morning's Post-Intelligencer, identical to yesterday afternoon's ad in the Times. A smaller version would run again tomorrow in Seattle and in the Portland Oregonian. After all, Beth's fingerprints had been found on an Oregon payphone. Agent Henning had told him to run everything by her, but she had also told him the FBI considered his wife a possible accomplice. That had changed the whole ballgame in Gus's eyes, heightening the need for self-help. To that end, he borrowed one of the computer experts from his law firm to help load pictures and information about Beth in all the right places on the World Wide Web, along with the offer of the reward. He even purchased an ad from America Online and other major internet services. For the next 24 hours, his would be one of a half dozen advertisement icons that popped on the screen when subscribers logged on. People wouldn't have to read the actual ad unless they clicked on the icon and opened it, so he had to be creative. Win $250,000 was what he came up with. It was a little slick, perhaps, but the idea was to get people to click and read. Have you seen this person wasn't exactly catchy. Less than an hour of his day had actually felt wasted. That was how long it took to return phone messages from the office. It was something he had to do, so in that sense it was productive. But when he had finished, it hardly felt like an accomplishment. He had voluntarily reassigned his caseload to other partners so that he could focus on finding Beth. That left little in the way of legal responsibilities, and last week's bloodless coup had shifted all his managerial responsibilities to Martha Goldstein. For the first time in his life, he wasn't the point man at the office. It was liberating, in a sense, knowing how easily he could divest himself of responsibility and chuck it all if he wanted. No one would be hurt, not the firm or his clients. On the other hand, such freedom didn't exactly stroke his sense of self-worth. It reminded him of the so-called Preston and Coolidge revolt some years ago. Gus had ruffled a few feathers by deciding to run for managing partner at the relatively young age of 38. He challenged his own mentor, a senior partner with 20 years more experience. 11 other senior partners threatened to resign if Gus were elected. Gus ran, and he won. The old guard made good on their threat. They left in a huff to open a competing firm right across the street. They did everything they could to hurt what was left of Preston and Coolidge. They reviled Gus in the newspapers. They made job offers to the firm's top young associates. They tried to lure away clients. Their actions created chaos and panic throughout the firm for about 2 days. Then the reporters moved on to stories more newsworthy. The lawyers went back to practicing law. The clients stayed put. It took about a week for the buzz around the water cooler to switch from, "Do you think we're going to make it?" to, "Do you think those crazy old fools are going to land on their feet?" In a month, it was as though the infamous geriatric dozen had never worked at the firm. Their influence as remote as the very dead Messrs. Preston and Coolidge who had founded the firm 100 years earlier. That was the beauty of the institution. No one was indispensable. Not even Gus. "We're back," Carla announced as she entered the house. She was carrying a bag of groceries in each arm. Morgan was behind her, toting a smaller bag. Gus met them in the kitchen. "Hi, Morgan."
"Hi,"
she said softly. "Can Daddy have a hello kiss?"
"I'm pretty dirty right now. I have to wash up before dinner."
She hurried from the room before Gus could think of something to say. He looked helplessly at Carla. "Is it my imagination, or am I actually losing ground with her?" Carla set the bag of groceries on the counter and removed her jacket.
"She's a little upset today."
"Is it the ad in the paper?"
"That could be part of it."
"What's the other part?"
"I haven't been able to get anything out of her, but I think maybe somebody said something to her at school."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Kids can say mean stuff."
"Maybe I'll have a talk with her."
"I'd leave her be for a while. I worked her over pretty good in the car. She's not ready to talk about it."
He nodded once, reluctantly. "All right, later." Together, they unloaded the groceries. Carla was like a machine, pulling things out in short and jerky motions, setting them down on the counter with a little too much force. "You mad about something?" asked Gus.
"I was thinking about what you said this morning."
"Which was what?"
"How the police are even considering the possibility that Beth has something to do with her own disappearance. That really frosts me."
"Hopefully they won't waste too much time on that."
"You know they will. It's always been that way."
"It's always been what way?"
"Everyone always wants to blame Beth."
"No one wants to." The bag was empty. She looked directly at Gus.
"But that's what they're doing. It's the same thing they did 5 years ago, when you two had your blow-up. Beth's a wacko. Beth needs a shrink. Beth needs a life. It's always her fault."
"This is not the same thing as 5 years ago."
"How is it different?"
"I'm not a serial killer, for one."
"That's only a difference of degree. Beth was a victim both times."
"I was the one she falsely accused."
"You were the one who drove her nuts."
Gus angrily folded the paper sack, then shoved it in the cupboard and slammed the door.
I thought we were past this, Carla.
She drew a deep breath.
I'm sorry. I'm not blaming you.
She paused, then added, No more than you do, anyway.
What does that mean?
Come on. A reward of $250,000? Even the FBI told you that was excessive. What prompted that? Love?
Frankly, yes.
And you want others to see how much you love her.
I'm not trying to prove anything, if that's what you're suggesting.
People who feel guilty always have something to prove. Had someone else said it, Gus would have erupted. But there was no fooling Carla, not his own sister, not Beth's best friend.
I don't see what good it does to say things like that.
Maybe it'll help you understand why your daughter won't kiss you hello. Gus stopped to think.
You think she blames me, too?
Of course she does, and she always will, so long as you mope around blaming yourself.
I'm not moping around. I haven't stopped looking for Beth since she disappeared.
And that's all terrific. But I'm talking about the very private moments, the way you act around Morgan, the way you look at her, the things you say to her, the things you don't say to her. Guilt is dripping off of you.
I just want her to know I'm sorry.
No, you want Beth to know you're sorry. But it doesn't work that way. Morgan can't grant you Beth's forgiveness, so stop looking to her as if she can, or you're just going to drive her further away.
He thought of his mea culpa at Morgan's bedside and her headphone response. Maybe Carla had a point, harsh though she was.
The phone rang, giving him a start. He answered in a detached voice. A woman was on the line.
I'm calling about that ad in the paper.
Gus was suddenly alert. Yes?
I know Beth Wheatley. I think I can help.
Who are you?
Shirley Borge.
Gus searched his mind but couldn't recall the name anywhere in Beth's past. How do you know Beth?
Seen her around.
Where? She didn't answer. From across the kitchen, he felt Carla's stare. She stood motionless, listening, sensing the urgency in his voice. He asked again, Where have you seen her? Still no answer. His voice hardened. Is this a crank?
Your wife had bulimia.
For a second, he couldn't speak. She added,
And she's the dumbest shoplifter in King County.
His throat tightened. What else do you know?
Plenty.
Where is she?
I got a pretty good idea.
Tell me.
Uh-uh. We gotta work out a deal first.
If you're worried about the reward, don't. I'll even sign a contract with you. I'll promise to pay you $250,000 if the information you give me leads to Beth's return.
That'd help.
Where would you like to meet? She laughed lightly.
I'd like to meet in Mexico, but I think it's best we meet right here, where I live.
Sure, where is that?
Gig Harbor.
He hesitated. Isn't that where?
Yeah. I'm at the Washington Corrections Center for Women. Is that some kind of problem for you?
Under the circumstances, I'd say that only enhances your credibility. I can be there tonight.
Good. But don't come if there's only money on the table.
What do you mean?
There's only so much chewing gum a woman can buy. I want out of here.
He froze, not sure what to say. I don't think I'm in a position...
I'm gonna hang up.
Don't, please.
You sound desperate, Mr. Wheatley.
My wife is missing. How do you expect me to sound?
Then help me, and I'll help you.
All I was trying to say is that it really isn't my place to negotiate your release. Something like this needs to be worked out between your lawyer and the state attorney's office and the Department of Corrections and whoever else is involved.
Fine.
Do you have a lawyer?
Yeah.
Who is it?
You.
What?
You are a lawyer, aren't you?
Yeah, but...
But you've never done anything like this. So what? This is about influence, not experience. Guy like you has plenty of influential friends. A lot more than that incompetent little twit of a public defender who landed me here in the first place. You expect me to go back to him?
All I know is you're asking for an awful lot. If you want money, I got it. But on something like this, I just can't guarantee anything.
Your guarantee is that you'll work harder than anyone to put this deal together. Because there's not another lawyer on the planet who has more incentive to get me out of here.
She had a point. He at least had to try. What are you in for?
Conspiracy.
Conspiracy to do what?
Murder.
It's not going to be easy to spring a murderer from jail.
I'm not in for murder. It was conspiracy to commit murder.
So what are you saying? Someone else was the trigger person?
I'm saying no one got murdered. It was a conspiracy. Just a plan. The police got wind of it before anyone got killed.
It's still not going to be easy.
You want your wife back, or don't you?
Of course I do.
Then get me out of here.
Okay, he said, his heart racing. I'll see what I can do.
Chapter 34. It was a J-shaped drive from Seattle to the Washington Correctional Center for Women, down the interstate to Tacoma, then back up to Gig Harbor on the western side of Puget Sound. In good weather and light traffic, the trip normally took about 2 hours. Gus made it in record time. Gig Harbor was a quaint harbor town with bite. It had plenty of lovely old-fashioned shops, restaurants, and bed and breakfasts. Getting there, however, meant a trip across the mile-wide Tacoma Narrows, where winds whipped so furiously across the water that the original bridge had twisted and turned and toppled into the sea just months after opening in 1940. It had been replaced by the world's fifth-largest suspension bridge. But Gus couldn't cross without one or two panicky visions of galloping Gertie, the ill-fated predecessor that had galloped too much. The prison was located just outside of town, a recently renovated compound that spread across several acres of cleared evergreen forest. Of Washington's 12 major correctional facilities, WCCW was the only one exclusively for women. Medium and minimum security facilities housed nearly 700 female inmates, their crimes ranging from property theft to murder. It was well after normal visitation hours when Gus arrived. Gus had spoken to Andy en route by car phone and told her all about Shirley Borge. Andy had called the Department of Corrections. If this inmate might help catch a serial killer, the warden was all too happy to allow an after-hours meeting. Gus entered the compound at the Close Custody Reception Unit, a long building that resembled old army barracks. A corrections officer led him down the hall to the attorney-client visitation area and checked him in. Gus entered booth number one, a small room with one chair. The door was behind him, white walls on either side. A glass partition separated him from an identical room on the lockup side. It was empty for the moment. He scooted his chair closer to the glass, closer to the phone box on the counter. He waited. He heard a noise on the other side of the glass. The handle turned and the metal door opened. Gus started to rise, forgetting for a second that there would be no handshake. He settled back in his chair. Shirley Borge entered. She looked right at him. The door closed behind her. She sat in the chair and faced him, saying nothing. For a moment, they just studied each other from opposite sides of the glass. She looked younger than she had sounded on the telephone, and she was much prettier than Gus had expected. She had sandy blonde hair and mysterious brown eyes. The face was thin, with attractive lines, the lips full. Still, she was a hardened 25. Andy had pulled her police record and shared it with Gus. Shirley had been convicted on conspiracy charges, but had a history of prostitution. A long scar ran from her left temple and down across her cheek. Someone had cut her badly, perhaps with a razor. Deep in her eyes, the anger was still there. Gus looked away, not wanting to be caught staring at her misfortune. His eyes drifted down her neck. Inmates didn't wear uniforms at WCCW unless they were in segregation. Shirley was dressed in baggy cotton sweats that were unzipped at the collar to the base of her cleavage, where a small purple tattoo clung to her left breast. The breasts were round and firm, but the tattoo was horrendous, presumably an in-house jail job. Again, Gus tried not to stare, but there was magnetism in this abomination. She tapped on the window, giving him a start. Gus looked up, embarrassed. The phone was pressed to her ear. Gus picked up.
"You like the tattoo?"
she asked. He blinked, even more embarrassed.
"I'm sorry, I was just trying to figure out what it was."
"What does it look like?"
"Kind of like a flower."
"Not a bad guess. It's my genitalia."
"Excuse me?"
She leaned forward, pointing and offering a closer look, as if she were an anatomical chart.
"I know it looks a little strange, but it's dead on accurate. My labia minora is much larger than my majora, a lot larger. They call it a full-blown rose."
He wasn't sure what to say. "I guess I'd never heard of that."
"Me neither, till I got locked up with 700 other women."
He squirmed, which she seemed to enjoy.
"You think I'm kidding?"
"I really don't care. I'm here to find my wife."
Her smile turned sly.
"You surprise me, being married to a shoplifter. I thought maybe you'd have a soft spot for the plight of us convicted felons."
"How do you know so much about Beth?"
"How are you going to get me out of here?"
She was glaring, but it wasn't contempt. It was just negotiations.
"Bottom line is that I can't make this happen overnight. I spoke to the FBI at length on the way over here. They don't just spring you from jail because you claim to have information that will help solve a crime."
"Then you've got your work cut out for you, don't you?"
"Yeah, but you have to work with me. It's like any transaction. The FBI has to know what it's buying, which means you have to show them what you've got."
"Where I come from, you get the cash on the dresser before you show the booty."
"This isn't the Happy Mattress Hotel. You can't just walk down the street to the next John and work out a better deal. You have one customer. The customer makes the rules."
She thought for a second, but she seemed a little less tough, as if starting to understand.
"So I tell them what I know. Then what?"
"The FBI uses your tip. If it turns out to be true and helps them find my wife, they write a letter to the parole board telling them to please take your cooperation into consideration at the next parole hearing."
"But there's no guarantee."
"No. The board can still deny parole."
She thought for a second, then the eyes narrowed.
"Fuck 'em, then."
"What?"
"They don't do the deal my way, I don't do it."
"That's not smart."
"Who are you to say?"
"I'm your lawyer."
"You're whatever I say you are."
"I'm here to help you."
"You're here to help yourself.
We can both win."
"I don't care. Just fuck the FBI. Fuck you, too."
"This isn't about me and the FBI."
"Damn right it isn't. It's about me."
"Go to hell, lady. It's about a 6-year-old kid who misses her mom."
Their eyes locked. He noticed the slightest twitch in her eye.
"You got a kid?"
she asked.
"Yeah. Morgan's her name."
Shirley fell quiet. He added,
"She's full of questions, you know.
Half the time, she wants to know why someone would take her mommy away. The other half, she wants to know why her mommy would leave her. It's hard to make a 6-year-old understand."
The silence lingered. They were staring at each other, the phones pressed to their ears. Then she blinked.
"I got a little girl, too. She's 4.
Girls are great.
She nodded.
I don't get to see her much.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too,
she said with a mirthless laugh. Pretty hard to make her understand why her mommy has to live here. Gus started to say something, then let it go. Shirley was thinking, weighing things in her mind, perhaps even agonizing. He could see it in her eyes. In a minute, she had shaken it off.
Tell you what, Mr. Wheatley. I won't just spill my guts to you like some fool, but I'm going to give you a chance.
That's all I'm asking for.
Here's the deal. The FBI has to prove itself to me. Convince me that they're willing to deal. So I want you to tell them to get me some privileges here. If they can do that, I'll talk. That'll show me they're dealing in good faith.
What do you want?
I want to get back on the prison pet program.
What's that?
It's a special program here. Some of the inmates get to keep dogs in their cells and train them. Then we give them away to handicapped people as pets. It's a nice thing. Makes you feel like you're doing something worthwhile. I did it for about a year or so. They kicked me off.
How come?
I let one of the dogs lick me.
Gus looked confused. She added,
you don't want to know where.
I see.
It was stupid. Just a spur-of-the-moment thing that grossed me out immediately. My luck, I got caught.
We all do stupid things.
Anyway, I went back on the program.
So this is a good way for the FBI to show me some good faith. If they can do a little something for me now, then I'll know they're taking me serious.
Then you and me can talk.
You can't just put the FBI to the test. You have to give up something in return.
I told you, I'm not going to spill my guts for nothing.
Just give them something little. This is a negotiation, Shirley. You can't expect people to do something because you want to test them. You have to horse trade.
She studied him, thinking. Okay. I'll give you a little something.
His eyes lit. Tell me.
In Yakima, there's a used clothing store called Second Chance. Lots of migrant workers shop there. Mexican apple pickers. Some Indians, too.
What about it?
Check it out.
Check it out for what?
Just check it out. Check it out yourself. That's all.
What do you mean, that's all?
That's all I'm going to tell you for now. You get me back on the prison pet program, I'll tell you more. You get a promise to reduce my sentence, I'll tell you everything.
She leaned forward, arching an eyebrow.
You get me out of here tonight, I'll show you my full-blown rose.
Gus just stared.
I'll wait to hear from you.
She pushed away from the table, then hit the call button. A guard outside opened the door. She shot one more look, then disappeared behind the steel door. Gus gathered up his things and hurried out in search of a phone. Chapter 35. Early Thursday morning, Andy and her supervisor were in Isaac Underwood's office. She had told Lundquist all about the WCCW inmate and her unusual demands. Right off the bat, they were in disagreement over how to follow up on the clothing store lead. Andy felt strongly enough about it to appeal to the ASAC. Lundquist felt strongly enough to follow right along. Isaac was seated behind his desk, directly in front of what was known throughout the office as the Wall of Teeth and Honor. Isaac had earned more award plaques and letters of commendation than any agent in the office, many of which were displayed in sprawling collage format behind his desk. In the center of it all were the teeth, the huge gaping jaws of a tiger shark he had fished from the Indian Ocean. For such a nice guy, Isaac had become quite facile in the art of office intimidation. Isaac was especially busy this morning. Though as ASAC he was technically second in command, he had been running the office since the special agent in charge had retired. Headquarters had yet to name a replacement. Isaac gave Andy 10 minutes, not a second more. Run over the time allotted, and the deadly jaws would come clamping down on your head. Andy spoke fast, summarizing for Isaac's benefit, then framing the issues. "Granted," she said, "the fact that the inmate is incarcerated at a state penitentiary only complicates things. To do this by the book, we have to go through the U.S. Attorney's Office, which would contact the state Attorney General's office, which would probably sit on it until Beth Wheatley dies of old age. Gus Wheatley's instincts were right, I believe. The situation doesn't give us the luxury of months, weeks, or even days to hammer out a deal with the bureaucracy." Isaac asked, "Has anybody considered the possibility that we're dealing with some bored inmate who's yanking everybody's chain for the pure entertainment value of it?" "Then how would she know about the bulimia, the shoplifting?"
"Valid point," said Isaac.
"What are you proposing, Andy?"
"First, I need to get you on board. If this inmate story starts to check out, it'll take someone at least at the level of an ASAC to make some phone calls and get the bureaucracy moving."
"We can deal with that after things check out. So get out of here and go follow your leads." Lundquist said, "That's really why we're here. There's some disagreement as to how we should check out that used clothing store." "You got 3 special agents on the Wheatley kidnapping team. Rock, paper, scissors. The loser drives to Yakima and pokes around. Any more executive decisions you'd like me to make for you?"
"That's where we disagree," said Andy.
"Fine, the winner drives to Yakima."
Isaac was being a real hard ass. It must have stemmed from last night, the brief lapse in the parking lot when he'd let his guard down. Definite overcompensation, thought Andy.
"The issue isn't who goes," she said. "It's how. I don't think it's smart for the FBI to march into the store and start flashing badges and asking questions. From all indications, we're dealing with a fairly intelligent serial killer. We don't know the nature of his connection to this clothing store."
"If any," snapped Lundquist.
"True, if any. But we could blow everything if we walk in as straight agents. We need to be more subtle, more creative."
"This is a pretty flimsy tip to start spending the taxpayer money on surveillance."
Lundquist piled on smugly.
"That's exactly what I said."
"It doesn't have to be surveillance. I can do a cameo appearance. The store caters to low-income Hispanics and Indians. I'm half Indian. I can play the part."
"What's wrong with that, Kent?"
Lundquist made a face.
"Because I can see how this is going to turn out. She'll do a cameo for an afternoon. Then she'll ask for another day, then for a week, and on. Before you know it, we'll be into a Group 2 undercover assignment to the tune of $70,000. And in 6 months, the auditors will come crashing down on my head."
Isaac raised his eyes to the ceiling.
"Did I hear someone say the sky is falling? Come on, Isaac. You know that's the danger of these cameos."
"To some extent, you're right." He glanced the other way. "How about it, Andy? Can you look me in the eye and tell me this is a one-afternoon cameo, nothing more?" She would have liked to say yes, but she never succored Isaac.
"Can I make a suggestion?"
"Sure. Just so we're not arguing about extensions day after day, let's just agree up front on a time limit."
"How long?"
"Give me 3 days. If nothing turns up, I back off the assignment."
Isaac nodded.
"Seems reasonable. You okay with that, Kent?"
He thought for a second, then said,
"Fine, 3 days.
"Good."
Andy rose and started for the door before anyone could change their mind.
"Thanks, Isaac. I'll pick you up a nice secondhand shirt or something."
"Don't forget about Kent."
"Oh, yeah," she said with a thin smile. "I'll put his on 6-month layaway."
3 days, he shouted. But she was already out the door.
Gus had hoped to hear back from Andy quickly, but as the day dragged on and last night's phone conversation played over and over again in his mind, he was no longer sure she even owed him a call. He had her assurance that she would do everything possible to work a deal with Shirley if her tips panned out. He could only assume that nothing had firmed up. That afternoon, he picked up Morgan from school. During the ride home, he tried to follow up on the hunch Carla had raised yesterday that someone was bothering Morgan at school. He asked general questions. How's school? Everything okay with your friends? The car was both the best and worst place for this kind of conversation. He had her captive, but with her riding safely away from the airbags in the back seat, he couldn't read her face or check her body language. He wasn't getting anywhere, so he let it go for now. He wasn't going to pop the hard questions and try to gauge her reaction in the rearview mirror. They were home by 3 o'clock. Morgan went to her room. Gus checked the answering machines in the kitchen and his study. Nothing. He gave Morgan a few minutes to settle into her room, then checked on her. The door was half open, enough for him to see completely inside. Morgan sat cross-legged on the floor, her back to him. The television was playing. He watched the back of her head, her thin neck, the slight shoulders that made it ever so clear what a little girl she still was. Then he watched the screen. It was the sound that had caught his attention more than the picture. She was playing one of her old video cassettes. Very old. It was called More Baby Songs. Gus remembered it because Morgan used to play it all the time. She was little more than 2 and had just learned to use the VCR. It was kind of a family joke, but at 26 months, she knew how to operate it better than her parents did. More Baby Songs had been her favorite video, and her favorite song was the one Beth had taught her. It was right about the time Beth had decided to go back to work for the hotel. The song was about a working mother who leaves her daughter at daycare for the day. The daughter cries when she leaves, but the song taught her not to. Because my mommy comes back. She always comes back. She always comes back to get me. Morgan's voice was cracking as she sang along. Gus watched from the doorway, his heart breaking. Because my mommy comes back. She always comes back. She never would forget me. Gus wanted to go to her, scoop her up in his arms and hold her, tell her yes, mommy would be back. But then she would see the doubt in his eyes, his own uncertainties about Beth. That would only make things worse. For the moment, Morgan was better off without him. She was better served by her videos and her songs and her memories of her mother's unconditional promise. He suddenly felt the chill, then the warmth of an ironic sense of solace, as if the very thought of Beth's promise erased any doubt of her return. It occurred to him that in this family, he was the promise breaker, not Beth. He watched a moment longer, then turned and walked away, a little more sad, and yet a little more hopeful.
This ends Disc 6. Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 7.
Chapter 36. His general direction was south, but it had been a zigzag route through Oregon. He had no specific destination in mind, so long as it was well south of the last dump site. Over the past 3 days, he'd moved from town to town, hotel to hotel, shopping mall to shopping mall. He was a compulsive planner, but above all, a realist. Selection of the next victim always involved a certain amount of luck. Lucky you, he thought, as he sifted through the purse of his latest target. He'd stolen it yesterday, having followed her to a crowded happy hour after work. 1 minute it was on the bar stool beside her, the next it was gone. Afterward, he'd stayed around to check her reaction from afar. The moment of panic, the frantic search, the realization that it was gone. He could tell a lot about a woman by the way she responded to a minor crisis like a stolen purse. Whether she took charge or crumbled. Whether she got angry or just sobbed. Whether she was a fighter or an easy mark. This one would be so easy. And she was a pretty good match, too. She was the right age and build, and the eye and hair color were the same. She was the exact height, according to her driver's license. She didn't work at a hotel like the others, but it was getting too damn hard to match them up that closely. He was cutting corners, admittedly, but time was of the essence. He waited on the east side of her house, dressed in black and nestled between trash cans. Low-hanging pine limbs blocked out the moonlight and shrouded him in darkness. A thick row of evergreen shrubs stretched from the fence to the house, presumably to keep the garbage cans out of view. It was the perfect hiding spot. Through the branches, he could see the driveway, which was empty. He had expected her home by now, but she was late, or at least later than the previous 3 nights he'd stalked her. It was getting colder by the half hour. He could see his breath. The rubber gloves were stiffening as the night neared the freezing mark. Finally, just after 9 o'clock, her car pulled up. The headlamp switched off. She stepped out and slammed the car door shut, then headed up the sidewalk with her house key in hand. The very sight sent his heart pounding. He could have jumped her right there, but that would have been an unnecessary risk. Women were always on guard during that trip from the car to the front door. Better to wait until she was inside, snug and oblivious, completely unaware of the killer outside her door. She appeared nervous as she climbed the front stairs. The locks had been changed, he knew. He had tried the key from her stolen purse. The new house key shook as she aimed for the lock. All that shivering might have been the cold night air, except that she was bundled up in a heavy winter coat and a warm knit hat. More likely, the theft of her purse yesterday had left her paranoid. She probably thought some guy with a knife was hiding in the bushes beneath her bedroom window. What an imagination. She finally opened the door and disappeared inside. A string of windows brightened one after the other as he monitored her movement from the foyer to the living room, down the main hall, and finally to the back bedroom. He knelt outside her window and peered inside. The blinds were raised a half inch above the sill, just enough for him to see inside. She was seated on the edge of the bed, but the way the blinds were adjusted, he could see her only from the waist down. For the moment, that view was just fine. She kicked her shoes off. The skirt dropped to the floor. She worked the sheer pantyhose down her long legs. It seemed to gather for a second at the calves. Very nice calf muscles. A jogger, for sure. Maybe some dance training. She pitched the hose aside and crossed the room to the full-length mirror. He could see her whole body now. Her face, her hair. The hair. Outside, the change had been hidden beneath her winter hat. The brunette was gone. She'd colored it. Son of a bitch! 3 days of preparation and planning for nothing. He was furious at first, until he realized it was his own doing, a manifestation of the immense power he wielded. The publicity had gotten to her. Yet another woman, unnerved by reports of a serial killer who targeted 30-something brunettes and who was apparently working his way south from Seattle. He wondered how many other women had been affected the same way and were now driven by fear. Though he realized the purse-snatching had probably driven this one over the edge. He watched as she slipped into her robe and admired her new color in the mirror. He was tempted to go through with it just out of anger. After all, the last one hadn't been such a perfect match either. Then inspiration struck. He could kill her and dye it back to the rich shade of brown it used to be. That would send a message that no one was safe. If you didn't look the part, the killer would remake you. Blondes and redheads were no longer immune. No more hiding behind your bottle of Lady Clairol. It was a stupid idea, giving a corpse a dye job. He had no interest in playing beautician. In fact, he had nearly lost interest in this one altogether. Those self-proclaimed expert profilers would probably say he was in some supposed cooling-off period. They'd say he was still too sated from the last one to get excited about the next. The FBI thought it had everything figured out, as if every serial killer on the planet went into hibernation after a kill and needed time to rejuvenate before the next strike. Some of them did. Some slept for days. But he wasn't like them. They didn't share his energy. quietly, as secretly as he had come, he sneaked away from the house. This wasn't a failure, his walking away. His lack of enthusiasm had nothing to do with timing. It wasn't even the dye job that had ruined the excitement for him. At bottom, he was simply losing patience with the whole scheme. After 3 dead lookalikes, he had to know. Was Beth Wheatley with him, or was she against him? Part 4, Chapter 37. Early Friday morning found Andy at Goodwill shopping for secondhand clothes. She bought 2 pairs of old jeans, 1 black, 1 blue, hiking boots, a stained sweatshirt, 2 sweaters, and a brown winter coat with a torn pocket. She returned to the office at mid-morning and met with a backup technician to construct her cameo persona. They didn't bother with a phony driver's license, social security number, apartment, telephone number, employment history, credit record, bank account, and other trappings of identity that came with a full-blown undercover operation. For such a short assignment, she needed only a name and a story. For the next 3 days, she would be Kira Whitehook, a high school dropout who had drifted in and out of trouble and part-time work for the past 10 years. It was not the kind of past to be proud of, which was perfect. She couldn't be expected to answer many personal questions. It took some effort to look the part of a transient. She did most of the work herself in one of the office changing rooms. She stripped the polish from her nails and cut them down jagged till they looked bitten to the quick. She had a few calluses from the weights at the gym. She roughed them up with a pumice stone and gave her knuckles a few nicks with the car keys. The hair was next. Too stylish. She trimmed it at the ends, making sure the ends were slightly uneven. She wet it and blew it dry for nearly a half hour till it looked baked and overprocessed. Finally, the face. The eyebrows were far too perfect, but she couldn't unpluck them. She shaved off the very outside tip of the left one. Nothing too distracting, just enough to create a little asymmetry, as if she'd been in some kind of brawl at some point in her life. She washed off every bit of makeup, but the CoverGirl complexion wasn't exactly in roll. She did a cakey, overbrushed job on her cheeks. A waxy brown lipstick helped harden the soft mouth. She checked the mirror and nearly screamed. Then it seemed funny. She imagined herself sneaking up on Isaac and telling him this was what she looked like on the morning after. Suddenly, it wasn't so funny. 2 weeks ago, she would have joked at her own expense, but now, for some reason, she wouldn't think of letting him see her like this. Life is too damn complicated. She wore the beige cable-knit sweater and baggy blue jeans. No jewelry. The rest of her belongings went in the duffel bag, along with $200 in cash, the entire budget she had managed to squeeze out of Lundquist. She left her FBI shield and credentials behind in her desk. The gun, a Walther PPK 380, she strapped to her ankle inside her pant leg. It was smaller than her usual Sig Sauer P-228, more suitable for undercover work. She left the office during the lunch hour, sneaking out the back so no one would ask her where she was headed or what the new look was about. No one outside the Wheatley kidnapping team, her supervisor, and Isaac would know she was working undercover. It was simply too dangerous to divulge a secret like that, be it to the victim's family, outside law enforcement agencies, or other FBI agents who didn't need to know. As much as she would have liked to assure Gus that she was following up his lead, phoning him was out of the question. The Greyhound bus left Seattle at 3:10 p.m. She probably could have driven, but the safest course was to stay in her role from the minute she left the field office. She was one of 11 passengers scattered about the bus. Andy had a window seat in the middle. She rode in silence, save for the occasional outburst from the 2 young boys with their grandmother up front. The creepy guy across the aisle made eye contact once, smiled, and pulled a big wad of chewing gum from his mouth. "Want some?" Andy looked away and ignored him. It was a 4-hour bus ride over the mountains. Seattle was separated from central and eastern Washington by the North Cascades, a beautiful range reminiscent of the Alps, which extended 700 miles from northern California to the Fraser River in southwest Canada. The western slope was the windward side, green and lush, and given to wet weather. Abundant water only heightened the beauty, creating huge reflecting lakes, rushing rivers, and impressive falls, like the one at Snoqualmie, an avalanche of water more than 100 feet higher than Niagara. Skiing at White Pass had been excellent this winter, and the views were astounding all year round. Mount Rainier, near Seattle, was the most impressive peak, permanently snow-capped and visible in all directions from 200 miles. There were 6 others of note, including Mount St. Helens, famous for having blown its top in 1980. The volcanic ash had drifted for hundreds of miles, falling like gritty urban snow in places as far away as the Yakima Valley in central Washington. The Yakima Valley was technically a desert on the leeward side of the mountain, where thick forests and green mosses of the windward side gave way to sagebrush and cactus on the brown, dusty plain. It was harsh country, given to extremes, cold in winter and hot in summer. Creeks could run dry or at a trickle most of the year, then gush with muddy torrents of sudden melted snow or unexpected summer rain. That a great flood had once converted the entire valley into a vast lake was both Indian legend and geological fact. The rest of the legend was just legend, there being no proof of the giant canoe that had landed atop Snipes Mountain and the young Indian couple it had brought to repopulate the valley. Whatever the lore, the Yakamas, not the Yakimas as they were later mislabeled, had indeed roamed the wind-billowed grasslands from time beyond memory, surviving on fish, berries, and camas root cakes. They had been nomads, the premier horse breeders and trainers of the Pacific Northwest. The white man had arrived in the mid-19th century, bringing cattle and farming and development and conflict. A land once without fences was now neatly sectioned off into huge quadrants of irrigated farmland. Row after row of fruit trees covered the hillsides. Apples in particular put Yakima on the modern-day map. That and crime. Andy had seen the FBI crime stats on Yakima, a city famous for its orchards but notorious for its violence. With roughly 50,000 residents, it was, per capita, one of the nation's most dangerous cities. At the risk of political incorrectness, some saw the violence as an inevitable offshoot of the daily clash of cultures. Native Americans wrestled with the problems that attended the stresses of reservation life, including a rate of alcoholism much higher than the general population. Hispanic migrant workers arrived in droves for the harvest seasons. They were poor, as in any transient population, and a few were outright dangerous. Most were law-abiding, but through no fault of their own brought out the worst in people who didn't speak their language. The white population was divided within itself, with plenty of hardy and long-time residents living in double-wide trailers right across the road from the beautiful new vineyards of the wealthy and visionary landowners who had pioneered Washington's trendy wine industry. "Yakima," announced the bus driver. Andy was one of only 3 remaining passengers. The others had gotten off earlier in Ellensburg. Andy put her coat on, slung her duffel bag over her shoulder, and stepped down to the sidewalk. It was colder than Seattle, just a 30 minutes of daylight remaining. Her breath crystallized in the crisp, dry air. A chilly gust of wind stung her cheeks. She wished she had invested in a pair of gloves, but that could be remedied at the used clothing store. She had studied a map during the ride and knew which local bus she needed. The number 5 bus was stopped at the traffic light just a 30 minutes away. With a 10-second burst, she reached the bus stop at the corner just in time to board. In 5 minutes, she reached I Street and North First Street. The bus rumbled as it pulled away, leaving her on the corner by the AM-PM mini-mart. From her research, Andy knew of the shootings there. At least 1 fatality. Farther north toward the town of Sela was an old hotel that had been converted to a mission. Good intentions, but a definite uptick in derelict foot traffic. Andy saw two of the homeless huddling in cardboard boxes in the empty parking lot across the street. She checked her watch. 4:45. They were bedding down for the cold night, no doubt. Andy would have to do the same soon. Just up the street were clusters of rundown motels and low-rent apartments, popular with hookers and boozers. To keep enrolled, she'd take a room there. But she was in no hurry to check in. The Second Chance clothing store was a couple of doors down. She was eager to pay a visit. It was a typical storefront with a plate glass window. The dresses on display were on hangers, not mannequins. Andy peered inside from the sidewalk. The store was long on inventory, short on decor. The overhead lighting was stark fluorescent. The old tile floors were cracked and stained. You could see where the previous tenants had kept counters and other fixtures that had long since been removed. On the shelves along the far wall were folded pants, T-shirts, and sweaters. Most of the clothes were hanging on the 5 metal racks that ran the length of the store. Dresses and skirts on one, buttoned shirts on another. Kids' clothing, winter coats, and miscellaneous items filled the rest. A few wedding dresses were on display in the very back. As Andy entered, the bell on the door announced her arrival. An old woman came out from behind a curtain in back. She was quite the sight. Wrinkled white skin, like an albino rhinoceros. Jet black hair, as if she'd dyed it with shoe polish. She said nothing, just watched. Andy simply acted like a customer. It was a strange feeling. There she was, browsing through used clothes, needing nothing, pretending to be someone she wasn't. Not really sure how any of this might help her find a woman she had never met, a woman named Beth Wheatley. The logical thing was to strike up a conversation and see where it went. She found a pair of gloves, which she needed. "How much are these?" The woman wasn't far away. She'd been hovering like a security guard, not about to be shoplifted.
"Whatever the tag says. You buy a few more things, I'll knock a little off."
Andy tried them on. "These are nice."
"I guess," she said.
"I'll take them." She handed them over, smiling. The old woman started toward the cash register. Andy followed and stopped before the counter. It was a glass display filled with costume jewelry, none of it very valuable. Andy shot a longing look at a string of faux pearls.
"I've always wanted a necklace like that." "All it takes is money."
"How much is it?" She punched the register, ringing up the gloves.
"More than you can afford."
"How much?"
"I can let you have it for $40.
"Oh." It wasn't worth half that, but Andy played dumb.
"I'm sure that's a fair price, but I'm afraid I don't have that kind of money." "Tough break."
"Yeah, I'm kind of out of work right now." She gave Andy the once-over, judging her appearance.
"What a surprise."
The register clanged as the cash drawer opened.
"That'll be $3 for the gloves."
Andy dug in her pockets for 2 singles and some loose change, acting as though it were her last $3. She counted out the dimes on the countertop, then handed it over.
"Maybe I could work here."
The woman raised an eyebrow.
"I don't think so."
"Looks like you could use some help around here, unloading boxes, cleaning..."